I'm Nick Harcourt, and welcome to another episode of The Sound of Success, the podcast where we talk with movers, shakers, and just plain cool people about music.
I'm joined for this episode of The Sound of Success by singer-songwriter and musician Neil Finn. Neil is best known for being in two of the most important bands to come out of his homeland of New Zealand, Split Enz, a band in which he shared writing and lead duties with his brother, Tim, and then as the lead singer, guitarist, and a founding member of Crowded House. He's also made collaborative records with Tim as the Finn Brothers, a series of solo releases, and he's been a member of Fleetwood Mac since 2018. As we speak today in May of 2024, Neil is readying the release of Crowded House's eighth studio album, Gravity Stairs. Mate, it's been a few years since we last spoke. I'm so happy to see you.
Nice to see you and talk to you, Nick. Yeah, good memories of our conversations back in the day.
So you started young, right? Family gatherings, sing-alongs around the family piano. Your brother, Tim, picked up the guitar first. What was life like growing up in the Finn household?
We were in a small town, New Zealand. My dad was an accountant. It was my mum was in the Catholic Women's League. We went to the local convent school, but it was not an austere environment because mum was Irish and most of their friends were Irish, and they all liked to knees up on the weekends and they liked to sing around a piano. And there was a fella called Colin O'Brien who knew every song in town and just sat there, and they plied him with cigarettes and alcohol and he played all night. And so we grew up with music around, and we were pulled out when mum and when they realized we could sing and we could harmonize together. I actually learned to harmonize off my mum doing the dishes. We'd sing You Are My Sunshine or various such simple songs, and she kind of taught me how to harmonize. But we were hauled out in front of our parents' friends to do little items, you know, Harry Belafonte songs. Tim tells me that he was really anxious about it, but I kind of think I gave it some credit for curing me of stage fright. But yeah, there's just music around a lot when we were, my dad was a jazz fanatic. My mum could play the piano, although she played almost every song she played in, just never changing chord. She'd always just play one chord and sing along to it. Right. It was the right starting chord generally.
Just put a different melody over the top of it.
Yeah, she was very adaptable. They all had a swing rhythm. She played I Got You, the Split Enz song, and I don't know why sometimes I, you know, it had a swing to it, and she just never changed any chords anywhere. But
did you start writing songs early?
I started trying to write songs early. I remember I got a Donovan record that was the first record I got when I was about 11, 12 years old. And it had a little poem on the back of it, which I set to music. This poem went, precious little do we drink the sun, kiss the rain or something. And I don't know what possessed me, but I wrote a little tune to go with that. And then my brother asked me a few years, I didn't really do anything else for a couple of years. They asked me to open up for Split Enz on their one of their first tours of New Zealand. And I was only 15 at the time. And he said, oh, you should write a few songs for that. And so I did. I wrote two or three songs for that opening slot and did a couple of covers as well. But that was the beginning of it, around about 15 in earnest anyway. And then once I joined the band Split Enz, I got more and more involved in the songwriting as time went on.
So you're what, about 18 or 19 when you're invited to join Split Enz? The band are already established. Were you nervous?
I was nervous, but you know, ignorance is bliss. And I guess I had watched the band and thought, I was very enchanted with Split Enz. I thought it was amazing. It was such an unusual band for anywhere, and particularly for small town New Zealand, to contemplate. So I would have loved, you know, I was thinking, maybe one day I'll get to join the band, but it came along a lot sooner than I expected. But I didn't have time to really get that nervous. I was probably nervous the first few rehearsals I did because I really wasn't a competent electric guitar player at all. I played acoustic a bit up till that point, and they're very different instruments. But they took a punt on somebody that they thought understood the ethic and the aesthetic of Split Enz, and they knew I could sing and Tim and I would sound good together, and they probably knew that I could come up with a song here and there in the long term. So, but it was, you know, they could have found much more capable electric guitar players than me. Took about 6 months to get myself into some kind of frame where I wasn't just, in fact, they didn't have me in the mix out front for the first few tours because I would get the tape from the sound mixer so I could check what I'd played that night, and there'd be not one scrap of guitar on there anywhere.
Did you didn't know that at the time, I'm sure.
when I was playing, I thought, oh, this sounds okay, but it didn't make the mixtape.
So we talk about writing songs, and once you were in that band, you wrote a couple that did rather well, like I Got You, and you became the principal songwriter at some point, right?
Well, I was certainly sharing the duties with Tim. He was continuing to write very excellent songs through that period, but I got a couple of songs away as hits, and it lifted the band into a different level of success. Meant we could we had a deal in America suddenly with A&M, and we toured a lot on the back of that record, and it was a real shot in the arm for Split Enz, because at the time we were probably hovering on the brink of not being able to afford to keep going as an art band. So, you know, having a pop breakthrough was good. And then I was just writing simple songs. So they became, yeah, the timing was good. They became popular, and yeah, we were off.
History Repeats was another one. And I remember I was actually living in Australia at the time. I don't remember if I told you this when we met years ago. I lived in Australia from 1983 through 1988. So I was around for the end of Split Enz, I guess. But the band did call it quits the end of 1984. And then next up was Crowded House. Can you tell us about that time in between the bands as one door closes and the next one opened?
Yeah, well, Tim had decided, my brother had decided that he'd spent his entire adulthood from the age of 18, 19 in Split Enz, and he needed to go and find some new pastures, and he'd done a solo record. So he kind of decided he wasn't going to be able to continue with Split Enz. So the decision was up to me as to whether I would continue with that band and become the front man. And I just thought there was too much history to take into account, and that it would be better for me to start afresh. We'd just found a drummer for Split Enz towards the end of our life, Paul Hester. He and I became very firm friends. We were the same age. So we talked about forming another band that we could fit into one rental car, and instead of a six-piece band that Split Enz was. And we found Nick Seymour, who auditioned. We actually auditioned bass players by giving them demos that we sent them off to try and to play bass tracks on our demos. And Nick came back with a very danceable beat on one of them. A groove that was on the bass, and it was unlike anything I had encountered before. And he kind of danced around, came in to play it for us in the studio. And he danced around the studio in he's probably awkward, but slightly, you know, he was very enthusiastic. So I kind of won us over in that regard. We thought, oh, well, he's a big personality, but we can deal with it. And then so that's how we were born. We went off and did a tour under the name The Mullanes. We decided to change that. It was not memorable enough. Went to LA, got a deal with Capitol. It all happened quite quickly in a way. And then the first album that we recorded with Mitchell Froom, he'd just begun his production career. We had this brand new band, and something clicked in a really good way. At a time, we didn't even have a name at that point. We named the band towards the end of that process. We had been called Largest Living Things for a little while, and then Barbara Stanwyck's Chest was one that came through. I don't know how that came about, but we became Crowded House. The album took a while to come on. It was two or three singles into the promotion where we suddenly released Don't Dream It's Over, and it started to get some heat. By then, we'd become a much better band by embarking on a whole series of acoustic sort of busking gigs in people's lounge rooms and restaurants and little clubs. And it was just, we did it for practical purposes so we could afford to go and promote our record. But it turned into something that was a real calling card for us. And, you know, so yeah, that three-piece busking style became one of our modus operandis.
I saw you in Australia the year before I left, I saw you. You were on tour with Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know what it was, the Manly pub or some pub, one of those big pubs in Australia where...
It might have been Selena's. We probably played in Manly too, but I remember we played Selena's with Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. I think it might have been New Year's Eve even, because the Don't Dream was just starting to take off.
Things were just starting to bubble. I remember that. And then I moved to the States not long after that, and fortunately found my way into radio where I was able to play your songs and your music on the radio. But it's amazing the difference that one song can make to a career, isn't it? I mean, you've got a bunch of great songs that dotted throughout your career, but Don't Dream It's Over, as you just insinuated, really sort of lit the touch paper for you.
Yeah, didn't it? Continues to have a life that's unexpected and beautiful, and yeah, I just feel quite grateful for it. It keeps getting you bought out and seems resonant for a lot of different reasons and causes and issues. I've left a lot of open doors in my lyrics deliberately in a way, and that does mean that they can be applied to a lot of different situations. It's a delight the way it's traveled. You know, as you say, I have got many other songs that I'm equally as proud of, but that one just has had some kind of life that's unstoppable. So I'm grateful.
So first time around with Crowded House, there were another three albums and more hits. Weather With You is another one that stands out to me. And then you disbanded Crowded House and kicked off a decade-long solo career. And that's when I first met you, I think, in 1998 here in Los Angeles. Around the first time we met, I remember you coming in and you did a cover of the Hunters and Collectors song, Throw Your Arms Around Me, in the studio, just with a guitar. And that was one of my favorite songs when I lived in Australia. And it was one of those moments where I was like, I can't believe that I'm doing this. I've got Neil Finn in here in front of me playing a guitar, singing this amazing Hunters and Collectors song. Now, I know that that's part of the gig. You have to go around to radio stations and do the press stuff that, you know, we all have to do for promotion, I guess. But those were special moments for me in studio. And you came back a few times over the years. We always had fabulous conversations. Your solo career at that time ran for what, about a decade or so?
I think I did an album with my brother in that period as well. But yeah, I was exploring new territories by being solo and working with different people, collaborators, and it was good for me as a writer. The band broke up at the time, and we did one final show at the Sydney Opera House in front of a lot of people. I thought I need to go and find another angle on things to keep the writing fresh, really. That was the reason. And that was a fantastic period. And that, from that point of view, I worked with some really great people. And you know, Wendy and Lisa were on one of the records. I had played with Jim Keltner came in and played some drums on a record, 1-0. Marius De Vries, I did a record with. Really good exposure to a lot of different people coming from different places. So you just became a well-rounded exercise, I think.
How did working with those other people and those collaborations impact your songwriting?
Well, I think every time you get in with somebody, you allow light into your process because somebody's going to play them a little different than, or hear them a little different than you would have. When you're completely solo and you're doing something, I do that here sometimes. You can create an artifice that's very hard to penetrate, I think. Like it's, everything's just, you know, all the cracks are filled in and everything's exactly in your one person vision. Whereas in somebody has different angles on it, it allows you to see the possibilities of your music. And as I said, let light in. And so you come back to it next time going, what would he thought? What would Wendy play? And how would she see this? And these are just little thoughts in the back of your mind, but they're good. They open up new pathways and new angles.
Came back to Crowded House first time around in 2007, I think, with the album Time on Earth. And then a couple of years later with Intriga, the band changed. You lost your mate, Paul.
That was in many ways the prompt for getting back together. We felt like we had to pay some homage to the whole idea of being a band. And I was hanging out with Nick a lot in the aftermath of losing Paul. He just became involved in the record I was making. And I thought, well, is this a Crowded House record? And I said, yeah, why not? Why not put some good vibes into the story instead of this big, horrible full stop?
And then another break. And I believe you started making some music at home for a while there with your wife, Sharon. And your kids are involved in the band now as well. Was it almost like going back to being a kid yourself, like getting the family around and making music together?
It seems entirely natural now. I mean, my boys, Liam and Elroy, have both gone off and developed their own styles, and they've had enough time not working with me where I think that they've kind of established their identities. So what was a lovely idea on paper has also become this really forward-moving thing with huge potential because they've brought a lot of their own styles and songs and ways of doing things, and it's keeping me fresh and keeping the whole thing fresh. And having Mitchell Froom back as well, who was our original producer, just means that it's a very soulful lineup that is very much aware of the history of the band and very deeply ingrained and emotionally attached to but it just feels like there's a really big potential now.
I think the first or second time I met you, you came on the old show and Liam was 14 and he was in your band.
That's right. He came out and that was doing Try Whistling This, which was my first solo album.
What is it like having your kid grow up and playing music with you, even though because I know he's had his own bands as well, and then now Elroy's in the band as well. How is that as a parent, let alone a musician?
It was great at the time, and it was a great experience for him, and he performed extremely well. He had long hair, and he was very much, shoegazing most of the time because he's probably a little bit shy in front of an audience, but it was fantastic in musical ways. And the whole family was touring at that time. Elroy was like 8, and it was a wonderful experience to all be on the road. Actually, at the time, Sharon, my wife, was doing the lights for that tour as well. So everybody was involved. I think Elroy memorably pulled the plug, flicked a switch for the lights, switched all the lights off at one of the gigs. Probably it's too appealing to think, oh, look at that big switch there. I wonder what that does.
Well, kids, they need attention.
Oh, no, it was great. I mean, we've just chose to always include the kids. And I had an open door policy with my kids. Like if I was in the studio, wherever I was, I always said that they could always come in and hang if they want. And if they needed me, just come and grab me. Like there was no closed doors. And that worked out really well for us. Yeah. And they came on the road like quite a lot, not all the time, but they had some education. But the education on the road was quite good for them, I think.
So doing some collaborations, working with the family, and before you came back to Crowded House, then you went and joined Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah, I'd already had a pretty big, broad experience of music, and then I got a call from Mick Fleetwood, who I'd got to know a little bit in the time just before that, and he'd actually played on a record that Liam and I made called Light Sleep. Mick had come down and done a few days' work on that. Yeah, but I was really not expecting it. He took about 20 minutes to get around to actually asking me. He's a man of, he's loquacious, verbose man. And he was shy about asking me because he didn't want me to think it was an audition. But in fact, of course it was. I went to Hawaii. I wasn't sure initially. We just started this stuff with Liam, and I went, oh, is this right? It's amazing and it would be fantastic, but is it actually right to do this? And Liam said, what, you're not going to go and stand in a room with and sing with Stevie and Christine and play with John and Mick and just, and I went, yeah, of course I am. Of course I'm going to try that and see how it feels. I went off. We went to Hawaii and had a play with them, and it felt good. Singing just felt like a really nice blend, and they were good people. They made me feel very welcome. I think maybe we had 2 days practice. The second day I was more, the first day was unsure about what was going on, but the second day felt really good, and they went off and had dinner, and Mick came back about 11 o'clock at night kind of flying and took his merry time about telling me that they'd said they all wanted me to join the band, and he was kind of playing me like a young Antipodean messing with my head. But so it all happened. It was such a strange adventure, but a wonderful adventure.
Are you still a part of Fleetwood Mac?
As far as it goes, I would say it's possibly on the website I still am in Fleetwood Mac, but I think it's a moot point because it seems very unlikely that Fleetwood Mac will do anything else now. And in what context, I wouldn't know if it ever came up. Having lost Christine, it seems far more remote as a possibility, but she's sorely missed by all of the band and me too. She was a golden person.
I got to speak with her and do an interview with her a year or two before she passed, and it was such a pleasure to spend time with her. She was so lovely and giving in the conversation as well, and yeah, deeply missed.
Yeah, I felt the same way about her, and she's funny and just one of the band. That's what defined her in Fleetwood Mac. She just turned up soundcheck, and she was one of the rhythm section. She really related to being in a band as one of the band. Not as the star out the front necessarily, although she undoubtedly was. But it was beautiful.
So after that tour, I know you were coming back around to doing Crowded House again. How did COVID impact your plans for what became the next album, Dreamers Are Waiting?
Well, we managed to get into the studio just before that all happened with a lot of enthusiasm and energy and got some really good rhythm tracks going. And then the lockdown happened literally just at the end of that session. So we were then sending files across the world to each other. And that in a way worked out, you know, worked out pretty good. So we had the best of both worlds, these live tracks, band playing in the room, and then the chance to really throw them up in the air and examine them. And yeah, we did a few things online. You know, we kept I did a thing called Fang Radio, and we did a whole lot of performances from Liam's studio in LA, and they were really good. They kept us in touch with our audience and vice versa. And they kept us playing. Yeah. And then we eventually got to do a tour of New Zealand long after the record had come out. It interfered, as it did with everybody, with our schedule. I mean, it was strange to put a record out and not be able to be there anywhere. We eventually got to do a tour of New Zealand when there was no other tours happening anywhere in the world because of the lockdown. But New Zealand had still maintained its, the boundaries had been working, and we were able to do a full New Zealand tour, which was a pretty glorious outcome. And eventually got to do touring everywhere with that record. And in the course of that touring, I think became a much, much better band. And as bands do on the road, and learned to trust each other and jam. And I'm really excited about taking this new record out.
So when we were setting this this conversation up, and I should thank our mutual friend, Brett, from Flight of the Conchords, who was on this podcast a year or so ago, and I hit him up and I was like, listen, I don't want to assume all Kiwi musicians know each other, but do you know Neil? Because I'd love to talk to him. And here we are a week later. So shout out to Brett.
Yeah, he's a busy man, but he's got time to set things up.
He's a lovely guy. They sent me the record. New management sent me the new record, which I've listened to a couple of times. It's fabulous.
Great.
Tell us about that. About this new one.
So we were about to tour Australia and went to a studio in Byron Bay in Australia, which had been closed for many years, but it was actually a real timepiece from the 70s. And I'd been there in the 70s, called the Music Farm. We were supposed to be rehearsing, but we thought, oh, maybe there's a chance we'll get a couple of tracks down. We hooked up with a local engineer producer called Stephen Schramm, who turned out to be a really great addition to the team. And in that session, only lasted a week, but we got quite a lot of work done and five or six of the new songs recorded. In fact, the first song on the record, Magic Piano, was recorded entirely there. And even though it's quite a sophisticated arrangement, we took 2 days to learn it. It was a really good way to start because the band had to really get down to learning and figuring out what we sounded like. But what you hear on that track, aside from my vocal, pretty much the sound of the band on the floor. So it was a really good first track to get. We felt pretty excited by that, you know, bit of magic piano, and set us off. Then we got together in LA for another week as a, you know, on the floor live band, and did another week in Auckland at my studio here in Auckland. In between times, we were still doing what we were doing on that last record and sending files to each other and allowing everybody to have their day in their own intimate space, seeing thoughts through, and often which ended up on the floor, cutting room floor. But it was again a great combination of live band playing and considered, you know, lock me in my room kind of stuff. Now it's exciting to have the record coming out.
And this time around, you'll be able to actually tour the record as it's released. You'll be able to actually go out and play the record as it's getting out there.
Yeah, it's a really nice feeling to be able to go and stand up for it and present it as it's becoming, you know, aired to the world. We're going to start very, very soon, and lots of touring coming up.
Okay, we'll get to the music questions in a moment. But before we do, I did just read last week or the week before that you have just sold your catalog to Primary Wave, which is a big publishing company based out of the States, I think. You've got so many songs, so many hits. One presumes that they will make money for a long, long time, but they're going to make money for somebody else now. What led you to the moment where you thought, yeah, now's the time to put these in somebody else's hands?
Well, this was quite a long time in the making, and a lot of discussions and a lot of assurance of people that I was talking to having the right, you know, care and concern for the songs. I'm confident about that. There is something about the simplicity of somebody else managing them all that is really appealing as time goes on, because they were actually quite complicated to manage. And I've got accountants in Auckland who have been doing it for me. But yeah, there's something nice and simple about divesting responsibility for the management of the songs. They'll travel as they do anyway. They already belong in the ether, to my mind. So I feel still just as connected to them as I ever was. I'll sing them. And yeah, but I just felt like it was quite a nice way to kind of separate myself from the business of them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Is it also like a bookend to a certain part of your life and career?
Yeah, in a way too. These things are, a lot of people I obviously artists, and sometimes they're older than me and they're doing it as some kind of estate planning or something, they say. That wasn't my motivation particularly, although it may actually make that simpler as well. But I hadn't thought about that part of it. I just something about divesting myself of them as a business was appealing. And a lot of people might feel exactly the opposite of it, that you own them and they're really important to own. But I always almost feel like I've already let them go, you know, they're out there now. And it seemed like a simple transaction.
Let's jump into the music questions. I ask the same questions of all our guests, and we'll start off with, what is your first musical memory?
I think my mother singing while she was doing the dishes. I was really little. I have an image of it because she used to, that was the great thing about the era before dishwashers. You know, people used to do dishes together, and it was kind of somebody wash, somebody dry. And I don't know if everyone sang, but we did. But at least maybe some stories got told, and it was a connection, you know.
What was the first music you bought with your own money?
First music I bought with my own money was that Donovan record that I mentioned earlier. It had a song called Candyman was the first song on it. I can't remember what it was called now. Isn't that funny? I'll think of the name of the album in a second.
Fairy Tale?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Fairy by Donovan, yeah. That had the poem on the back of it that I set to music.
What was the first concert you went to?
The first proper concert I went to was Elton John Western Springs in Auckland on his first. He had a live album that came out with a date. It was just a date on it. And it contained quite a lot of the songs on his first album and also the second album. And it was my first concert. I was 14. It was absolutely amazing. It was only a 3-piece lineup from memory. And he was extraordinary.
What was it about being surrounded by a whole bunch of other people and experiencing that music live that touched you?
Well, I really loved his first record anyway. And I was 14 at the time. I was going to boarding school in Auckland. I was taken out, allowed to go out for this show. They had put plastic seats out in Western Springs for every single person. I think there was 18,000 people there. So it was 18,000 plastic seats. I remember standing on them, and it was just his energy in those days, Elton. And I mean, I don't say that because he doesn't. He certainly has the energy, prerequisite for playing in any age. But he was just like a force to be reckoned with in those days. And the songs were all universally great. And his voice was incredible. And I'd already got into listening to his records. So it was an extraordinary experience to see the real thing. And in New Zealand, we didn't have many opportunities. So there wasn't that many shows being put on. This was one of the first big shows in an outdoor setting that actually got put on in New Zealand. And I continued to go to quite a few of them after that.
What do you listen to when you want to dance?
Well, James Brown is pretty much the go-to, really. Can't go better than that.
What do you listen to when you're feeling sad?
I listen now to a lot of African music, and particularly stuff at the moment from Mali, Tanawa and Ali Bakature. There's a whole strain of music coming out of that part of the world that I find really uplifting and will get me out of a slump.
If you could only hear one song for the rest of your life, what would you pick?
God, that's a hard one. Probably one without vocals. I'd pick Tanawarin, but I don't know which song. But I think the vocals would make me get tired of it. Maybe Sleepy Time Down South by Louis Armstrong, if I had to pick one.
Do you have a favorite music video? And if so, what is it and why?
Music video, Hard to Go Past Ashes to Ashes by David Bowie. At the time, it was extraordinary. It still is. And the song itself is extraordinary anyway.
Is that the one where he's walking on the beach?
Yeah, with the clown. He's dressed as a clown and his mother died him and that. There's a lot of other stuff in it as well, but it's a very memorable video.
Do you have a recent musical discovery that you'd like to share with our listeners? It doesn't have to be anything necessarily new, but new to you.
This is not new. There's a guy called David Fanshawe. He traveled around Africa and Indonesia and in particular South Pacific in I think the 60s, and he did some field recordings. And I've just become really, really attached to an album that he did called Music of the South Pacific. And it's incredible singing chants from the South Pacific. And I'm trying to track down people that do this kind of stuff in Auckland at the moment. So it's very current. This is not new music, but I would recommend people to listen to it. He had another record called, Music of the South Pacific's got some chants, also got some amazing other stuff on it. Romanum 1 is a particular song on that record, but it's all sorts of different things in the South Pacific. So I'd recommend that. You can look, discover old music and it can be new.
Well, that is one of the great things about streaming, isn't it? There's lots of conversations about the bad side of that, but the point is that it does expose a lot of music to people who would never have had access to that kind of stuff before.
No, that's right. And it's, this is another one, is Emenatuki Mangaya is on that record, and it's incredible singing. Yeah. It's great thing is you can check things out as soon as you hear about it as well. You know, like it's one thing to write a note in your book and go, oh, next time I'm in a record shop, I'll search for that. But if somebody tells you about something and you can immediately go and listen to it, it's a real blessing.
Is there a band or an artist that you love personally, but feel that perhaps they never quite got the break they deserved?
Split Enz. I'd say early Split Enz. I wouldn't include myself in that, but
before you were there,
before I was there, what an amazing band they were. Totally unusual. Mental Notes for anybody who wants to check it out, or Beginning of the Ends, two amazing albums. And yeah, it's okay, isn't it? I'm not pushing my own barrow exactly, but I'm pushing a family barrow there.
Do you have a musical guilty pleasure?
Well, I'd say it used to be the Bee Gees, because their disco period was so uniformly dismissed by people in our generation as being, you know, crappy disco. But I got into that a lot. I mean, I wouldn't be guilty about it whatsoever now.
Right.
But at the time I got into listening to their songs, it was, you know, the people around me wouldn't have thought that was all that great. Actually, I remember Tim was also listening to Hot Chocolate at the time, and he thought that was a slightly guilty pleasure too. It was just where we came from. We, for some reason, I don't even know why we'd be remotely guilty about anything like that. But at the time, the lines were drawn, you know.
It's hard to explain to people who perhaps are under 40 or definitely under 30 that there was a time when you picked a genre of music and that's what you liked. You weren't allowed to like anything else. If you were listening to prog rock, you were not listening to Tamla Motown, and vice versa.
Those barriers are really down now, and it's a really good thing. I like, you know, cross-genre popping is very common, and it has to be applauded.
And our final question, how are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling pretty good right now. I've just in the throes of getting packed to go away in a week. So my brain's a little bit fried and thinking about what I have to get ready, but I'm feeling excited about having new music coming out, getting together with my band and playing. You know, it's music seems more valuable than ever. And in the world that we're living in, it is one of the few things that almost everybody in the world can agree with. Music is great.
Well, it's been great talking to you again. And
thanks, Nick.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I'm looking forward to seeing you on this time around with Crowded House. I know you're going to be in LA and hopping around the world.
All the best to you.
Thanks, mate. Great to see you. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.
The Sound of Success is hosted and produced by me, Nick Harcourt, for Nude and Ginger Productions. Our theme music is by Keita Klein. For more episodes, find us on Apple and Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends, and thanks for listening.